This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Ups and downs in life of the individual and in national life. There is a particular phenomena in the evolution of morality in society, which is recognized peculiarly in Torah, or uniquely in Torah. And that is the phenomenon of Yiridas Hadoiris, of the fact that there aren't ups and downs when it comes to the evolution of universal morality. There are only downs. It's down all the way. Which is a depressing thought in some ways, but it needs to be understood. And there are various, many different aspects to that concept of Yiridas Hadoiris, to the continuing deterioration of the moral fiber, the moral character of the generations as history develops. And what I want to analyze this evening with you is, based on the Medrash that I spoke on last night, the particular cause or the particular area, if we can try and focus down on the area in which, one of the areas, one of the primary areas where Yiridas Hadoiris is evident in the world of the Torah. The Yiridas Hadoiris is a concept contrary to the popular beliefs of every other area of human endeavor. Society thrives on the belief that we are progressing, and society would find it very difficult to live with the notion that we are not progressing, that we are retrogressing, that we are deteriorating. That is not a comfortable thing to live with. And in truth, technologically, we are progressing. We are able to do things today in science and technology that would have been unheard of, undreamed of, a generation or two ago. And even each year, each month, there is enormous progress in the area of science and technology. And so the secular world lives with a notion of progress, while the Torah world lives with a notion of retrogression. And that difference is very important to appreciate in all the areas in which the Torah world and the secular world come into contact with one another. The area of Yiridas Hadoiris, as we saw in the Medrash last night, affects not only human beings, but it seems to affect animals as well. But even animals aren't what they used to be. Where the Medrash asks,
Lo yu gemolov shel Avraham Avinu doimim lechamoiro shel Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyi? Were the camels of Avraham Avinu not as good as the donkey of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyi? That's very strange, because the donkey, the camels of Avraham Avinu used to go around muzzled, and they used to go around muzzled so that they wouldn't come to eat, to graze in fields which did not belong to Avraham Avinu. So they went around with muzzles on.
What about Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyi's donkey?
Nasvua listoi avdis gabun tlatin yomim v'leitam tklum.
This donkey of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyi was stolen and for 3 days wouldn't eat anything.
Amrin soifo maise v'tisri ma'arto aleinu nimsuro l'ribayinu.
The ganovim realized that this animal was going to die if he was left any longer without food. And they said to one another, let's get rid of him, let's send him back to his owner. We don't need a dead donkey on our hands. We'll cause the cave to smell. We won't be able to get rid of him.
Shalchuav also bevesa demara.
They sent the donkey and it went back to its master's home.
Kivand also marked the chakim kalo.
When it got home, it made an awful noise outside the home of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyir.
Omar, and he said, Pischu loiso ani over yavu lo detechu.
This le klata yomin de le tant midi.
Open the door for that poor animal and give her something to eat.
That donkey has gone for 3 days without food.
Yavin le tzorin le tamtun. They gave barley to the donkey and the donkey wouldn't eat. Amrin le Rebbe, Yavin le tzorin le tamtun. We don't know what to do, Rebbe. We gave the animal barley and the animal wouldn't eat. Omalohun taknatsuah, he said, did you take meiser? Have you tithed the barley? Amrin le in, they said yes. They didn't burst out laughing and say, what do you mean tithed? Does the donkey know whether it's tithed or not? They took it quite for granted. It was quite a normal conversation. The donkey isn't eating, Rebbe. Did you take meiser? Yes, we did take meiser. Take it for granted that the donkey would never think of eating from something where meiser wasn't taken. Afiktun demai? So he said, well, maybe what you gave the animal is demai. Demai means that it's food from which you're not sure whether meiser has been taken or not. You're not sure whether it's been tithed or not. Maybe that's the problem.
Omru le, they said to him, Lo kein alfen rebi alokeach zera lebehema vekemach loiris v'shem en lenei v'shem en losuch v'esakelim p'turim en ademai.
If one buys food not for human consumption, but for animal consumption or for chemical usage, you taught us, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyer, that if it's demai, if it's doubtful whether meiser was taken or not, whether it's been tithed or not, you don't have to worry. You can use it even if you're not sure whether it's been tithed.
So this is for animal feed. We didn't feed this barley to you. It's correct. The barley was demai. We were unsure whether the barley was tithed or not. And that is the barley we put before your animal. But the halacha is that we're allowed to do so. We didn't do anything wrong.
Omale, my navi, you're right. What can I do? My navi, what can I do with this donkey? V'hi machmer es al gromer. This donkey is very machmer. This donkey goes beyond the requirements of the law. The halacha only says that the donkey can eat it, but he is machmer. He's not prepared to touch it. A very frum donkey.
And we discussed last night that that's the first thing that needs clarification, the concept of a donkey that's machmer. What does it mean?
Rabbi Yirmi Yasholach Rabbi Zeira Chad Kaito Dutainin. Then there's a corollary to that story. Rabbi Yirmiyah sent a basket of figs to Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Yirmiyah Omar Efshe Rabbi Zeira Achilun Deloy Misakno. Rabbi Yirmiyah says, I don't have to take Meisr because Rabbi Zeira would, in any case, will always take Meisr. He will never assume that Meisr has been taken. So if I take Meisr and then I send the figs to Rabbi Zeira, he'll take Meisr again. It'll end up that 20% will be taken instead of 10%. That's a waste, unnecessary. So I won't take Meisr, he'll take Meisr.
Rabbi Zeira Omar Efshel Rabbi Yirmiyah Dela Mesharach Lohun Mitkina. Rabbi Zeira said, this is a gift from Rabbi Yirmiyah, I'm sure Meisr has been taken. There's no way Rabbi Yirmiyah would send a gift without Meisr having been taken.
Ben Dein Ledein is Achlun Te'enim B'Tzivlayim. Between the two of them, it happened that the figs were eaten without Meisr being taken.
Mocha Kam Rabbi Yirmiyah and Rabbi Zeira. The next day Rabbi Yirmiyah and Rabbi Zeira met. Amar le, and he said to him, Takan Tilin Ta'anya, these figs you sent me, did you take Meisr by the way?
Amar le, he said, no, I didn't.
Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Yemina le Rabbi Zeira, Rabbi Abba Bar Yemina said to Rabbi Zeira, In Havim Kadmui Malochin Anan Benenash.
This is the famous graphical depiction of the extent of the deterioration of the generations of Yerida Sadeiris. If the earlier ones were like angels, then we are like human beings. V'inhavim b'nei nash anon chamrin. And if we are like human beings, if they were like human beings, we are like donkeys. What Rabbi Abba Bar Yemina is saying here is that the difference between a generation ago and ourselves is not merely a quantitative difference. The difference is not merely one of extent of learning and extent of righteousness, but this is a completely different species. The earlier generations and we are totally different species. And what's important about the difference between species is their inability to fully understand one another, to comprehend one another. If you're talking about one species, a better type and a lower type, they can at least comprehend one another. They talk the same language. But if you're talking about two different species, they're unable to comprehend one another at all. My father always used to tell the story about a dog that he used to have that used to really understand people. And he used to wait outside, and when my father used to come home, the dog used to go out to meet him and used to follow him up. And the dog used to look at him like a companion. He could understand everything that he did. He could understand. He was a friend. There was some kind of relationship. And they would go inside,
and the dog would get something to eat, and my father would get something to eat, all that the dog could relate to. He's got food, everything's fine. Then my father would sit down and pick up the newspaper, and the dog would think, this is a mashugana. Picks up a piece of paper and stares at it. It's not a bone, he can't put it in his mouth, it's not a ball he can run with. Pick a piece of paper and he stares at it. There's no way that you can train the dog to appreciate what the human being is doing. That's what this means in the Medrash here. When you're talking about a different species, there's a point at which you're incapable of understanding of any type of comprehension of what that species is all about, what its value system is, how it operates, what its choices are based on. There's no way one can understand that. A human being cannot understand what it is to be an angel, just as an animal cannot understand what it is to be a human being. And the chiddush of Rabbi Abba Bar Yamina is that same inability to comprehend applies between any two generations in the Torah world. We cannot think of ourselves and think of the earlier generation as like us, just better. Like us, but they knew more. Like us, but they were more righteous. The earlier generation wasn't like us at all. There is no means of comparison. There is no ability on our part to comprehend from any point of view what they were really like. We can't do it. It's not possible. And adds Rabbi Abba Bar Yamina, the less anan kechamru said Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoy. And when I say that we are like donkeys, if they are like human beings, then we are like donkeys, I don't mean like Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoy's donkey. I mean like ordinary donkeys. Chamru said Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoy Yavun Lisari the Tfilu Le'achdus Yasei. When the donkey of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoy was given produce from which Maaser was not taken, the donkey wouldn't touch it, even though he hadn't eaten for 3 days. And we were brought a gift, a basket full of figs, and we didn't know whether Maaser had been taken or not, and we were able to eat it. We were not able to sense that Maaser had not been taken. That was the Medrash that I brought last night. The essence of the Medrash revolves around an incredible concept, and that is the theoretical ability to sense halacha. That halacha is not just a system of actions which need to be acted out, but there is a physical expression of the existence of the consequence of a halacha, which theoretically a sensitive human being should be able to pick up, and even an animal can become sensitive to. That there is such a thing. There's a lot of discussion among the Baalei Musar, and it's based on a Rambam, as to the concepts of the Muskolos and the Murgoshos, which I've spoken about once before. The Muskolos are concepts, intellectual concepts, and the Murgoshos are things which can be sensed. And man's knowledge is made up of one or of the two or of a combination of those two types of knowledge, of information. There is information which we have which is intellectual information, conceptual information, and there is information that we have which is sensed in your sensual information, information that we feel, that it's not in our heads and our minds. If we feel it, it's in our bodies. For example, the difficulty with dieting is that if you tell a fat person that to eat sweets and chocolates is going to make them fatter, they know that. You're not telling them anything new. The problem is that's conceptual knowledge, and you're fighting against sensual knowledge. The sensual knowledge says it's delicious. And that's not intellectual, that's sensual. And intellect cannot win a battle against the sensuality. The sensual is stronger than the intellect. And when the intellect and the sensual come to battle with one another, the Rambam already says, the intellect doesn't stand a chance. The end of the day, it doesn't stand a chance. And that's why these diet clinics and so on make a lot of money, because people get very desperate, and they don't know this principle, so they carry on with intellectualizing it, and it works a little bit, and then it wears off. Or, to put it even more clearly, the intellect has a strength that the sensual lacks, and that is that intellectual information can be retained for a lifetime. Once you know it, you might never forget it. So if you're taught that sweets and chocolates make you fat, you can be told that once by a doctor, by a dietitian, somebody of authority, and you don't need to be told that ever again. That's a piece of information that 80 years later you will still retain. And you'll say, where did you learn this? Who taught you that? Oh, when I was a child I was told. I remember it. Sensual information wears off very quickly. It lasts, it's very dramatic, it's very powerful, it's very strong, but it wears off very quickly. So what the diet clinics really try and do is they try to convert the information, the mental information, to sensual information. And they do it by showing you the effects. They put you on a scale and they show you how your weight has gone up or it hasn't come down. That becomes a sensual thing. You actually see you are fatter than you were last week. You can see last week the scale stood at that point and now it stands at that point, and you can see with your eyes you're fatter. That's it. That shakes one. And they try and convert as far as they can, and they try and speak about it, not in a mental way only, but they try and emotionalize it. They try and really make you feel sensually disgusting at what you've done. Which is fine, it just doesn't work for long. For another, when you leave the diet clinic for the next couple of hours, you don't eat sweets and chocolates. But a day later, 2 days later, you're back again. And so it's a lifetime program. If one wants to stay on that kind of program, it has to become a lifetime program. So these businesses do very well. Same with the clinics that try and stop people smoking. Everybody knows it's bad for you, yet people still smoke. It doesn't help knowing that it's bad for you. Knowing that it's bad for you is okay if you've never enjoyed a cigarette. But if you've enjoyed a cigarette, if you've really enjoyed a cigarette, you've had true geschmack from it, it doesn't help knowing that it's bad for you. You don't stand a chance. That's not going to fight, that's not going to win the battle. Once Murgoshus and Muscolus come into conflict with one another, there is no way for the Muscolus to win over the Murgoshus. Intellect doesn't win over sensuality. So what people tend to do very often is to submerge and to denigrate their sensuality, which is very serious, because that way you can win. We talked about that in the ladies' shiur this morning, that by pretending it doesn't exist, or by denigrating and really subjecting it to enormous oppression, one can pretend it doesn't exist, and one can in fact find that one is able to run one's life on the basis of muskolos, on the basis of intellectual knowledge, because now the sensual doesn't exist. But one of two things happen: either it breaks out one day when one least expects it, or one creates abnormal people. One creates maladjusted people who are one-sided, developed minds, developed intellects, and underdeveloped personalities. The whole sensual side of their personality is lacking. It should be possible, says Rabbi Abu Bar Yamina, theoretically, it should be possible for a human being, using his senses, to determine that Maaser hasn't been taken from its particular product. Just as the donkey of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyo did it. The donkey of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyo did not use prophecy, he wasn't a prophet. The donkey of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyo did not use intellect, he didn't use muscolus, he only had murgoshus. An animal only has sensuality, it has nothing but sensuality. And with that sensuality, that donkey could sense that Maaser hadn't been taken. And says Rabbi Abu Bar Yamina, we are not of that level because we can't sense it. The degree to which our sensuality is tuned into Torah is lacking compared to earlier generations. That's what I mean, says Rabbi Abu Bar Yamina, when I say if they were like human beings, we're like animals. That we are unsophisticated to that degree where we don't have the ability to relate to Torah concepts sensually, to relate to Torah concepts with our senses, not only with our minds. Rabbi Yerucham asks an interesting question on the advice that Yisro gives to Moshe Rabbeinu, where he says, "V'ator secheze mikol ha'om," and you seek out from all the people, "anshei chayil," powerful people, talmidei chachomim, people of enormous knowledge, "yirei elukim," God fearing, "anshei emes," people of truth. And this is on the standards of Moshe Rabbeinu. We're not talking on contemporary standards. We're talking on the standards of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is the type of person you should seek out. And in addition, he adds "seinei votza," which the Ramban translates as being people who are unable to tolerate evil, oppression, unfairness. Asks Rabbi Yeruchim, how is it possible, why is it necessary to add that? If these people are Anshei Chayil, they're Talmid HaChomim, they know the whole of Shas, they're Yirei Elohim, they have enormous Yirei Shemayim, and they're Anshei Emes, they're men of truth. Why do you need to add to that, and they must be people incapable of tolerating injustice? Surely anybody who has those earlier characteristics is going to find himself unable to tolerate injustice. That's the question of Rabbi Yeruchim. And Rabbi Yeruchim answers that the midos, the characteristics in a human being, can be in potential and they can be in actual. Sometimes one has characteristics which are in potential and sometimes one brings them to actuality. And he gives the example of potential energy. He says, we know that in every piece of matter there is potential energy. There's potential fire. In most items of matter, take a piece of coal. That can be turned into fire. If you turn it into fire and you pour water on it, the fire will be extinguished. The fire and the water won't go together. But if you put the coal in water, the coal doesn't mind. So he says, when you find energy is in its potential form, it can live with its opposites. It's only when it is actualized, when that energy is brought from potential energy to actual energy, then it can't live with its opposites anymore. Then it has to have its own frame of reference. It has to live with its own elements. So he says there are certain midas, there are certain characteristics in the human being, which when they're brought to actuality, cannot tolerate certain other characteristics. But while they're only in potential, they can. So you can have a man, says Rabbi Yeruchim, who is potentially a great Talmid Chacham. He is potentially a big Yorei Shemayim. He is potentially a man of truth. It's all inside him. All those characteristics are there. That's the kind of person he is. But it isn't brought to the surface. Such a person will be able to tolerate injustice. It doesn't offend him to the same degree. What is Rabbi Yeruchim really saying? Again, it depends whether one's characteristics are muskolos or mulgoshes. If one's concepts are concepts, then you can live with antagonisms to the concepts. If the concepts are real, you cannot. You cannot tolerate. And here we begin to understand the role of, and I'm going to use an unfortunate word, because it's become a negative word, the role of extremists, of fanatics. There is a place for it. And one has to be careful not to become fanatical in one's denial of fanatics. There is a place for fanaticism, and that's what we're going to analyze and decide and discuss. Let me give you an example. A reform minister, let's say, who doesn't believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he doesn't believe in Tchiyas HaMeisim, and he doesn't believe in Teirah Min HaShemayim, he doesn't believe in anything. And he's a minister of religion, he has a temple. And he walks into an Orthodox shul, and they give him an aliyah. And he walks up to the Torah and he says, Baruch Hu Hashem Amaveiroch. What do the lay people say there? It's nice, he comes to an Orthodox shul, very nice, says a brocha. Ah, at last we're making progress, Orthodoxy and Reform are coming together, isn't it nice to see? And a Talmid Chacham sits there, and what does he do? He has to get up and walk out. Why? Because he's making a scene? Because he's taking a stand? Because he's enunciating a principle? Because he's standing on his rights? It's just totally intolerable to him. Because to him it's not just a concept, somebody gets an aliyah, says a brocha, it's a nice formula, it shows his identification. The words mean something to him. The man is getting up there and he's saying, Baruch Hu es Hashem Amaveiroch, blessed is the blessed God. And you know the man's laughing. Doesn't believe in a God, doesn't believe in a blessed God, nothing, the whole thing's a mockery. How can one tolerate it? So the degree of tolerance depends on the extent to which what is happening is real and to what extent it's merely symbolic. If life is symbolic and if value systems are symbolic and if the Torah is symbolic, one can tolerate anything. Just as coal can tolerate water, it's only when it's burning that it can't tolerate water. The moment it becomes real to one, the moment it's no longer a formula, the moment it's no longer a symbol, But it's in essence, it's a reality. Then it has to fit in with reality. It cannot be a lie. There's another example. I was walking in Israel once years ago, when the tensions between the religious and the irreligious in Israel were much worse than they are today. And I was walking with an uncle of mine, Reb Lazer Lopian, in a very irreligious area of the of Israel, on a Friday night. We're walking home from shul together, and Reb Lazer is a very, very quiet person, poetic sort of person, big Talmud Chacham, tzaddik, with strong views, but a very gentle soul. We're walking home from shul, and there's a big, massive Israeli, his chest sticking out, smoking a cigarette. And the Blazer walks right up to him. The Blazer was a man probably nearly well in his 70s at the time. Walks up to this huge ruffian, looks at him in the eyes, and says, "Smoking on Shabbos. Sis, aren't you ashamed of yourself?" And he slaps the cigarette out of his mouth. And he walks on. And I didn't know where to run. And this massive Israeli just looked at him and said, "Slicha. Sorry." And I thought to myself, what would happen if I tried that? Why did he do it? He couldn't tolerate it. He just couldn't tolerate it. He saw what it was doing to the man. He saw what it was doing to society. He saw what it was doing to Shabbos. He just couldn't tolerate it. What would I do if I walked past and I saw a child picking up a cup of arsenic and beginning to drink it? Would I start figuring out how to be sensitive, and what will he think of from Jews if I take it away from him? Is that what I would start calculating? There would be no shame of you. Push it away from him. Give him a hiding and take him back to his parents. And if it was an adult, what would you do? You would do the same. No calculations, no thoughts. Because it's real. If a person's drinking arsenic, that's serious. If it's just making on Shabbos, nikifelach. So he doesn't believe, a different thing. It's not real to us. That's where the difference is. Our ability to turn muskolos into murgoshos, our ability to take concepts and make them no longer concepts, they're reality, that's what it's really all about. That's what we have to develop. That's the art that has to be developed within our Torah. To be able to take intellectual concepts and make them into real physical things that can be felt, that can be touched, that can be smelt, that's what one has to be able to do. And so it is in all areas of halacha. There's a halacha in the Gemara brings in Brochus. What do you do if you're walking in the street and you suddenly discover that your trousers are shaknis? Got wool and linen mixed together. Not allowed to wear them. What do you do? Are you allowed to go home to change? Are you allowed to go into the... What do you do? The halacha is, I've never seen the halacha in practice, but the halacha is you take your trousers right off there and then. There's nothing else to do. What can you do? We can't understand that. It's a very difficult. We just pray that such a halacha will never come our way. We hope it just won't happen. But there's an odd thing that we wouldn't be too comfortable doing that. If we came up to you in the middle of the street, and particularly if it's in a posh place, imagine you're in the middle of some club or in a hotel, in your dinner suit noch, and hundreds of people all around. I come up and whisper to you, by the way, that suit you're wearing, shatna is. It's a nasty thing to do to somebody, but we would have great difficulty in doing what the halacha requires. This is, by the way, not in all cases. There are many cases of halacha where, because of COVID abrius, because of respect to other people, you don't do that kind of thing. But shatna is one of the cases where that is the halacha. You take your trousers off. We would find that very difficult. But what would happen if we were in that same place and Eugene Tablanche walked in and said, "Give up your Yiddishkeit or I kill you"? What would we say? Go ahead. Do what you want. No difficulty. We'd give our lives. So why is it? To embarrass ourselves by taking off our trousers that are shackled, it's just a few moments of embarrassment. That's all it is. How long will it take for somebody to come and give you something else to put around you? Just a few moments of embarrassment. That we wouldn't risk. Our egos we wouldn't risk. But our lives we would gladly give. How do we understand that? It's not because our egos are more important than our lives. It's because when Eugene Tablan stands with his revolver and says, give up your Yiddishkeit or I kill you, you're dealing with murgoshes. Real physical things that you can see exactly what's happening. Your Yiddishkeit is being threatened publicly, you're being called upon to sacrifice your life. That's Kiddush Hashem. It's clear, it's dramatic, it's murgoshes. This is not concepts you're dealing with, this is real things. And when it comes to shatnez, it's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, it's a sefer, it's a Torah which Hashem gave us, and Hashem will understand after all, embarrassment and this, a whole lot of terutzim. We deal with it as an idea, we deal with it as a concept, we don't deal with it as reality. This is not our souls under siege, our souls under threat. It's just playing with ideas and playing with concepts, that's all it is. And so we find a way to handle it. That's the difference.
The Gemara says in Dachof in Brochus, Omale Rav Papa La Abaya. Rav Papa says to Abaya, Maishno Rishonim de Israchish Luhu Nisa, U Maishno Anun de Loi Misrachish La Nisa.
Rav Papa was very worried about this phenomenon of Yiridas HaDoiris, of the deterioration of the generations, particularly in a very obvious area, and that was the extent to which miracles used to happen in earlier generations. And he goes on to say, if it's because they learnt more than we learn, they don't. We learn more than they do. If it's because they know more than we know more than they knew. If it's because they're bigger tzaddikim than we are, we're not. We've got bigger tzaddikim than they had. He couldn't find any one thing that they did better than we did that would justify this enormous difference that miracles happen to them and no miracles happen to us. Says Rav Yehuda, in Rav Yehuda's day, he used to take off one shoe and already, and rain used to come down before he fasted, before he dove. Imagine, just prepared himself for a fast and it used to start raining if there'd been a drought. We shout and we scream to the Ribbono Shel Olam and we fast and we do all sorts of things and the rain doesn't come. Omar Leis, Abaya answered Rav Papa, Kamoi habukol masri napshayu akadusha asashem, onan loy masrin napshayu akadusha asashem. The earlier generations used to give their lives for Kiddush Hashem, and we don't. That's the difference. Strange thing. Even in our generation, people would give their lives for Kiddush Hashem. What does Abaya mean? They wouldn't give their lives for Kiddush Hashem. And he gives an example. Ki hod Rav Ada bar Ahavo. If you look at the case of Rav Ada bar Ahavo, Chazio lahai kutis tahavius levisha karbalta b'shuka. This is a similar case to the case of Rav Lezer that I told you about a few moments ago. Rav Ada bar Ahavo saw a young girl wearing very unsneersdika clothing in the marketplace. Sovar de Bas Yisraeli, he thought she was a young Jewish girl. Kam karamino, he got up and tore it off her. Igloy milta de kusisi, it came out afterwards, she was a shiksa, she was wearing, quite entitled to wear whatever she wants to wear in the marketplace, it has nothing to do with him. Shaimua ba'arba mea zuzi, so he volunteered to pay the damages for having damaged her item of clothing, it came out to 400 zuz. 400 zuz at that time was a good few thousand rand, it was a lot of money. Omale Mashmech, he said to her, what is your name? Omrele Matun, she said, my name is Matun. Omalo, he said, Matun Matun Arba Meazuz Shavya. Matun means being careful, being deliberate, thinking things through, not being impulsive. So he says, Matun Matun, had I been a little bit more careful, Arba Meazuz Shavya, that would have been worth 400 zuz, I could have saved myself by thinking a little bit more carefully before I did it. Be that as it may, this is the example that's given of Kiddush Hashem, of being Moser Nefesh for Kiddush Hashem. Where's the Moser Nefesh? Costing 400 zuz, that's all. The Moser Nefesh is, that's what Moser Nefesh means. To be able to do something, the example that I gave you, to take our clothes off if we're wearing shatnez, that we wouldn't do. To give our lives, we would. Why? The essence of Mesirus Nefesh, giving our lives for something, is because it becomes a murgish, because it's real. We will give our lives for something real. That won't be such a problem. One finds ordinary people in times of great stress do the most heroic of things. At times of war, how people are Moser Nefesh to save one another, to help one another. Soldiers that go out together, what they'll only do to save one another. Things that they would never do in peacetime. Why? Because the threat is clear. They see the threat. You know, the story is the Six-Day War was perhaps the time where these stories abounded more than any other war, although they've applied in all the wars. But that was the time where there was just so much of it, so much happened in such a short time, And it happened because of that kind of mesiras nefesh. There were cases, I remember, where there were an army had to get over a barbed wire fence. It wasn't just a fence, it was a whole distance of the most vicious barbed wire, and the soldiers had to get over quickly, and there wasn't a moment's hesitation. The first line of soldiers threw themselves onto the barbed wire so that the army could walk over them. There was absolutely no question about it, not to waste a moment trying to find any other way of doing it. When they had to make the road up the Golan Heights, everybody knew the soldiers were up, the Syrians were up at the top shooting down. They had to build a road. How do you build a road when you're being shot at? So everybody knew the first ones that go out will build a few meters and they'll be killed, and then the next ones will go and they'll build a few more meters and they'll be killed until they'll get to the top. So one would think that there was a dearth of people volunteering to be the first. There wasn't. They fought over who would be the first. That's Mesiras Nefesh, because the threat is clear. If we don't, we're finished. We're all finished. There's just no question about it. It's not muskolas. You don't have to sit and reason it out. The threat is in front of you, and people become heroic when they see the threat physically, when they realize what's at stake. They become heroic. The whole Second World War was like that. When you realize what it is, people become heroic. Would people give their lives for similar threats if the threat was muskol, not murgash, if the threat was an intellectual threat? When did they start giving their lives to defeat Hitler? Everybody could see intellectually at the beginning what was happening, but nobody was willing to give lives yet. Everybody could see what was happening to the Jews. Nobody is willing to give lives yet. When people realized that England was going to go, then the Englishmen said, we're willing to give our lives. Not a question of a projection of what might happen sometime in the future. It's imminent. It's going to happen. There's no question about it. When there's no question about what's going to happen, we're able to draw on enormous resources within ourselves. And we're able to do the most heroic of things. If we see it as a mulgash and not as a muskal, if we're able to visualize it, then we're able to do heroic things. We would be able to take our trousers off in public if it was shatnez. If we saw shatnez as a threat to our neshonas, as a threat to our ilam habo, if we physically saw our ilam habo in front of us, if we saw all that, and we realized what we were denying ourselves by continuing to wear the shatnez for another second, there would be no question of stripping it off. That wouldn't bother us. If our trousers were on fire, what would we say? Got to find a place to change. Anywhere for me to change? Wouldn't say that. There would be no question. Because we know what we're dealing with. It's a murgash. We feel the heat. We feel the fire. If we were able to feel the fire of shatnez, it would be no question how to do it. That's Mesiras Nefesh. Mesiras Nefesh doesn't mean giving your life for Torah. How do you give your life? You give your life for something that you see in front of you. When you see in front of you all the time, that's Mesiras Nefesh. Then one's able to do all sorts of things differently. One is able to draw on the most unbelievable resources within ourselves to achieve heights, to achieve levels of heroism that we would never have thought possible. Because it's clearly in front of us. We can see the consequences without any question. We can sense it. And when we sense these things, we're able to respond with amazing energy. And so it is with anything. And be lying in bed, tired out after a terribly hard day, gone to bed late at night, and you've just fallen asleep, and you're in the middle of that delicious deep sleep, and you hear a noise outside, and in a second, like a flash, you're up, energetic, alert. What's happening? You're threatened. But after 8 hours of sleep, when you've had an easy day before, the alarm clock goes, time for davening. Difficult. It's not so easy. What's more important? What will happen? There's a gun outside. So what? Firstly, the chances are it's a cat. And if it isn't a cat, it's probably a dog. And if it's not a dog, it's probably somebody coming to visit one of the maids. And if it's not that, and it's tacky or a gun, the chances are he'll have a look around. He might not even come in. He'll see your house as protection. He'll see a dog. He'll go away. And if he comes in already, what's he going to take? A television set, a hi-fi set. What's he going to take? Your neshama's not at risk. What's he going to do? At real worst, he'll kill you. That's the real worst. He'll kill you. So you've lost your olam hazeh. But you've still got your olam haba. What's the big deal? But you're up and you're alert. There's no problem. When it comes to a threat to an olam haba, a davening with a tzibur, a possibility to learn it, a shir, to really advance oneself in a way which is worth much more than one's entire household, there we find it difficult. Why is it? Because it's less important to us? No, it's not less important to us. And then we ask ourselves, we were talking last week about the ups and downs, we get all guilty. And we say to ourselves, what's wrong with us? Does it really mean that physical things are more important to me than spiritual things? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Of course spiritual things are more important to me. Of course my Olam Haba is more important to me. Of course Torah is more important to me. The only difference is one is muskal and one is murgish. One I know about and one I feel. And when it's a conflict between what I feel and what I know, what I feel wins no matter how unimportant what I feel is, and no matter how important what I know is. That's not what determines. At the level of importance is not what determines the value system. Or let us say it determines the value system. But one's character decisions within that value system are based on on what one feels as opposed to what one knows. What you feel is the way you act, not on the basis of what you know. And so that's Abaya's answer to Rav Popper. That Rav Ado Barahava went up to this young girl. It wasn't a wise thing to do. It wasn't a thought out thing to do. But he just saw the danger. He saw things unfolding. Here's a young Jewish girl dressed in this particular way. What's going to happen? She's going to walk around with the young Jewish boys. And he just saw it all happening in front of him. A destruction of a society. In their society, in our society, these things are happening all the time. We don't react and we don't respond. We become desensitized to it. But in their society, he saw this as the possibility of destroying the whole society, of destroying the Kedusha of Klal Yisrael. Not a possibility, he saw it as a certainty. As he would have reacted to a fire, as he would have reacted to poison, as he would have reacted to anything else terribly destructive. And what does he do? He goes and rips it off her and teaches her a lesson. Then it turns out she's not Jewish. To pay 400 zuz. But that's Mesiras Nefesh. Why is it Mesiras Nefesh? Because he felt it. He didn't know it. Had he known it, he wouldn't have reacted that way. He reacted on the basis of what he felt, not only on the basis of what he knew. Of course, one has to be careful. As Chaim Shmulevitz used to point out on this Gemara, the other side of the coin, and that is, note that the Gemara regards this as Mesiras Nefesh. Acting impulsively is like giving your life. Because, explained Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, most times when you act impulsively, you are giving your life. You're risking your life. And even this case of Rav Ado Barahava, he acted impulsively, it cost him 400 zuz. Normally it's not a good thing to do. When can you act impulsively? If your impulses are dictated by feelings of Torah, then it's called positive Mesiras Nefesh. But if your feelings have been developed from the street, if your feelings are just natural animal feelings and you want to try and act impulsively, then you're going to get yourself into all sorts of mischief and trouble. That's a different sort of thing that one has to bear in mind too. But what Rav Abba Yamina was complaining about in the Medrash is that in the previous generations they had an impulse of Torah. They had a sensual feeling for Torah, where everything they knew became real to the extent that their response to it was as the same as a response to something physical, not to something conceptual, not to something intellectual. And that's why miracles were done for them. What is a miracle? Nature is miracles hidden behind a system of science. A miracle is when you see it when it's obvious. When we treat the world conceptually, the world treats us conceptually as well. There are concepts. There's gravity and there's this and there's that and all sorts of concepts which the world obeys and is governed by. But when we treat the world sensually, openly, without that kind of contrived approach, the Ribbono Shel Olam responds to us with that same kind of openness. But that's a different discussion. Briefly, before we conclude, I want to touch on the question of how does one develop that? It's true, we're talking about earlier generations. We're not going to get to the level of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair's donkey, even in the time of Abaya, even in the time of Rabbi Zeira and Rabbi Yirmiyah, they weren't on the level of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoy's donkey in this sense, in the sense of the sensual appreciation of the Torah. Yet some degree of it we have to have. The first thing, as I mentioned in the ladies' shiur this morning, is to be careful that in our educational system, and this applies both in the home and at the schools, we don't deny and submerge human sensuality. That we understand and we recognize its place and we find ways in which to give it legitimate expression rather than try and develop a negative approach to it. And one has to be very careful in the way one communicates with children and with oneself for that matter in that area. Because the natural tendency of the type of education and the pressures under which we live is to damage that feeling of sensuality. For example, you're walking with your child in the street, and an ice cream boy comes along ringing his bell, offering the most delicious looking ice creams, and the child says, "Can I have one of those?" And you say, "No, it's trash." What are you really saying with that statement? How could you want such a despicable thing? That's what you're really saying. How does that get translated and converted and internalized by the child? A desire for ice cream is a terrible thing to have. And if you do already, then at least let it be kosher. But it's a terrible thing to have such a desire. And then you walk a little further, and the child starts telling you about something naughty that his friend did at school. He says, "Ah, lashon hara." So what does the child think? A desire to speak, to share information about another person. Good, negative information. That's terrible. I'm really a terrible person. Just now I wanted an ice cream. Now I want to talk about people. And over a period of time, the child is becoming more and more restricted in his view of himself, to the point of where he sees himself as nothing but a mind, nothing but a brain, that is allowed to do a very limited range of activities. Even that brain is only allowed to do a very limited range of activities. Whereas theoretically and practically it's not always easy, but if one can understand the principle, one can try and work on it. When the child says, "Can I have the ice cream?" the question should be, "Why do you want the ice cream?" And the child will say, "Because it looks delicious." And imagine then if the father said, "It doesn't it? Oh, it does. It really looks, I must say. My tongue's hanging out for one too. Pity we can't." But aren't we lucky that we know we can't? The Torah says we're frum. We know what we're allowed to do, what we aren't. Aren't we lucky? Look how many people don't even know they can't. What are we saying then? It's not wrong to want an ice cream. It's fine to want an ice cream. That's sensuality. Nothing wrong with it. But not a tray of ice cream. We can't have it. Want it, but can't have it. That's it. That's a completely different approach to his own sensuality. And when he wants to start talking lashon hara, you say to him, "I know what you're about to say, and I know what fun, and I'm dying to hear about it, because it sounds so mischievous. But what would the other person feel like if he knew you were telling me? Wouldn't be nice. So why hurt the other person? Why should we have fun at the expense of the other person? Lashon hara is great fun. Can't do it. It's going to hurt somebody else." Isn't that a completely different education? Lashon hara! How can you say it? Different education. It is such fun. Pity we can't. Let's try and find a way of having fun without talking lashon hara. Can we find another way? That there's nothing wrong that the child stops developing the idea that there's nothing wrong with a desire to have fun, with a desire to have an ice cream, and so he's able to develop a relationship with his own sensuality which does not subject and submerge his sensuality completely. What's important about that is he can then at a later stage start utilizing his sensuality within his Torah. Completely different thing. And that applies in many areas. Firstly, in the straight area of Hakoros HaTov, the whole basis of Avodas Hashem is to recognize the goodness of Hashem and to respond to that goodness. But if we don't have sensuality, how do we recognize the goodness? If we don't feel the goodness, how do we really say a brocha with great joy if we don't enjoy the food we're about to eat? If it doesn't really mean that much to us either way. And so the whole area of responding to the Ribbono Shel Olam and to the wonders of his world are enormously restricted if the human being has lost the capacity to appreciate those wonders in a very ordinary, sensual sort of way. Quite legitimate. There's nothing wrong with enjoying sensually the beauty, the gifts, and the chasodim of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the way they're meant to be enjoyed. When we eat our necessities, there what we're thankful for is that we can keep body and soul together. That's one. That's not sensuality. That's just thankful for basics. Although even there's probably a sensuality. That's why we have to say a brocha even for a glass of water. We can enjoy such a thing. But when we enjoy luxuries, and we see there's a place for such things on Shabbos, you don't have only necessities on Shabbos. You have three meals, not one meal. You have meat, you have fish, you have good things, nice cakes, things that are made specially. There's such a thing as enjoying. And that has to be enjoyed sensually. How do you enjoy sensually? if one has lost the capacity to regard one's sensuality as legitimate altogether. So we have to be very careful to see that we don't delegitimize our sensuality and the sensuality of our children. Yet we don't allow it, chas v'sholem, to lead us and to dominate us. That also not. On the one hand, we're told that we're not permitted to follow our eyes. On the other hand, al tishkoch es kol asher roei necho b'sinai. Don't forget what your eyes saw at Har Sinai. Not just what you learned, what you heard about. The importance of visualizing, of seeing a concept sensually. We have to use our senses within our Torah. Not only in the sense of relating to the physical world, but we have to be able to relate sensually to the physical world, but we need to be able to relate sensually to the spiritual world as well. A person needs to be able to enjoy his learning. He must have geschmack, he must enjoy his Torah. He must enjoy his mitzvahs. Not that that's the purpose of them to be enjoyed, but he doesn't grow, his personality doesn't develop if he doesn't have some kind of pleasure, some enormous geschmack, some enormous real sensual pleasure out of spiritual things too. And listens to a piece of music and one has sensual pleasure. How can you have sensual pleasure from music but not something physical? But it's appreciated through the senses. One can have sensual pleasure. And so when one hears a chidush in Torah, or when one is mechadish in Torah oneself, there is a sensuality to it. There is a tremendous pleasure that results from that. And it's the development of the legitimate pleasures that automatically takes care of the illegitimate pleasures. If one is building a life that is so rich and so full of pleasures which are pleasures of kedusha, pleasures of sanctity, you don't have to spend a lot of time redirecting yourself or your children or your students away from that which is illegitimate. But one has to have the ability to enjoy that pleasure. Rebellion used to ask in the pasuk in Mishnah in Parikhes, Li Eitzo V'Sushiyo Ani Vino Li Gvuro. I am the source of advice and help. I am knowledge and power is mine. And the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, why is the Torah called Tushia? Because it's Mateshes Koicha Shalodom. It weakens a person. Makes one weak. To learn hard makes one weak. Arts rebellion, but then this pasuk is contradictory. It starts off saying, Li Eitzo V'Sushiyo. I have knowledge and Tushia, which we now say means weakening, the power to weaken you. Ani vino, I the Torah am understanding, li gvura, and I am the source of power. There's a contradiction. How can I be the source of power if I'm the thing that weakens you? And the Rebbe used to explain the two parts of the Sedra of the Pasuk are speaking about two different stages in learning. Li Eitzo v'sushia, the first part is talking when I am, Eitzo is, you're dependent on somebody else. Somebody else has to teach you, somebody else has to tell you. When somebody else has to teach you and tell you, Torah is a drain. You have to put a lot of work in, you have to integrate what they're telling you. It's a drain, it takes it out of you. But ani vino, when you have it for yourself, when you've grasped it, when you yourself are creative in your learning, when you're able to take an idea and project it further, when ani vino, when I am the source of my own understanding, li gvuro, then it becomes a source of power. Then it becomes a source of energy, it gives me energy, it doesn't drain me. And one finds these two stages in one's learning. There comes a time when you sit down to learn and it's draining, and at the end of it you feel terribly tired. And there's a kind of a learning, when you're finished with the learning, you feel stimulated. You felt tired before, you had a migraine before, and at the end of the learning, you feel that you're ready to go, you're ready to conquer worlds. It depends whether it's Li Eitzo, or whether it's Ani Vino. If I'm being fed, it's draining. If I'm self-creative in my learning, it's stimulating. One has these two levels, one has to get oneself to the level where it becomes Li Gevuro. Some people are saying to me, Shalosh Shuvos this evening, how lovely it is on Monday nights we started an informal learning program where people just come here 8 o'clock or 8:15 and they sit and learn. Some in groups, some on their own, some with their wives, some with their children, some with one another, whatever it is. And what a pleasure it is. Not an intellectual pleasure, they were telling you. No, apart from the intellectual pleasure, the spiritual pleasure, a physical pleasure. It's just nice. Come in with a chaver and sit down and learn. The place is nice. Have a cup of tea and coffee. Go home afterwards. It just feels very good. And they were asking me, how come there are so many people who don't take advantage of it? Because it hasn't become murgoshus yet. It's very difficult to turn a muskal into a murgash, to develop the capacity to feel the pleasure of something spiritual. But until one feels the pleasure of that something spiritual, self-motivation doesn't start. Once you're feeling the pleasure, you don't have to worry about motivation. You have to motivate somebody to do something that he finds no pleasure in. You've got to motivate him. But once he's finding sensual pleasure in, you don't have to motivate him. He's self-motivated. And that is the art of self-motivation. To develop the ability to take the things we need to do and we want to do and make them geschmack, find physical pleasure in them. So there are two ways that has to be done. The first is by making sure that we haven't denied our sensuality, that our sensuality is still intact, that we are capable of doing it, that we have a sensual personality that is capable of plugging into spiritual things. And the second is to develop the capacity to find that sensual pleasure in spiritual things and intellectual things, to take muskolis and change them into murgoshis, to take concepts, to take intellectual things and to convert them into physical things, where a mitzvah, where a halacha, where the understanding of a piece of Torah is not a concept, it's not an ideal, it's not a formula. It's something real, it's something actual that one is able to relate to and to be able to get that kind of pleasure from. And that ties into the theme that we started discussing last week, the ups and downs. The downs are when one's operating in the area of muskolus, when one knows that things are important and one can't bring oneself to do them, when one feels demotivated. There are things one would like to do, one would like to make further progress in one's learning, one would like to make further progress in one's Yerushalayim. There are certain shiurim one would like to go to, there are certain mitzvahs one would like to be doing, there are certain chesed we would like to be doing. And the more we learn about it, the more guilty we become. And that makes one all the more depressed sometimes, all the things that I should be doing and I'm not able to do, and that sends one into a downward spiral. Those are the downs. The ups are so easy. If we just sit down and start developing a bit of geschmack, we choose something and decide to enjoy it. Say, this is something I have to do. I'm not going to do it as a duty that I have to get out of the way, because that's not going to bring me anywhere except to the job having been done. I want to do this in a way that I'm going to enjoy. I want to get pleasure out of it. Plain, unadulterated pleasure. And if one is able slowly to shift one's emphasis and to find in the routine things that one has to do, in the daily things that one has to do, the davening. It's all very well saying, taking an attitude to one's davening, I have to daven. Fine, if the attitude is I have to daven, then what you're going to land up doing is trying to get it over with the least amount of pain in the quickest amount of time. The same as one does all duties. Something which has to be done, let's get it over with the least amount of pain as quickly as possible. And you'll succeed. You'll get the davening over with the least amount of pain as quickly as possible. But you'll be left empty. You'll be left with no inherent desire to daven again tomorrow. Tomorrow you're going to have to do exactly the same thing. Have to daven again. Oi, come round again. Davening time again. Let's get it over with the least amount of pain as quickly as possible. But if one decides one's going to enjoy it, it's a different thing altogether. I might invite you to a concert, for example. And you might not be an enormous appreciator of music, but you decide, no, I have to schlep along, might as well enjoy it. So you don't come late, to start with. You come on time. And you don't only come on time, you come a little bit early, but you're relaxed by the time you come, that you're in the mood already, you read up a little bit, you listen carefully, you decide you're going to enjoy it. At the end of the period, something will have remained, something will be there. And so it is, if one takes davening as an example, one decides, I'm going to enjoy it. Something, not that I have to do, but it's something I want to enjoy, I want to get pleasure out of it, sensual pleasure. It's possible to do, it's very easy to do, if one adopts that attitude to it, and one sets about it in that way. The same with Shabbos. We've often mentioned how little things rub off on children, and how careful one has to be not to instill into children a negative attitude to things which they shouldn't become negative about. And Shabbos is one of those danger areas. Davening is one of those danger areas. Learning is one of those danger areas. Oh yeah, I've got to go to the shiur again. What time is it? Oh, I've got to go already. I'll see you later. Take your sforim and off you go. You're setting the child off who sees that day after day with such a disadvantage that he's going to have to overcome later on. What is a shiur to him? It's something you have to get over with, something you have to do. And you have to do it with the least discomfort in the shortest time possible. So you go as late as possible and you get back as quickly as possible. And if you can have your mind on something else during the shiur so that you don't actually notice it, as if you're desensitized, or if you can take a sleeping pill, that's the best of all. You get it over with without any pain and suffering at all. That's the child's impression of a shiur. And one's life becomes like that. Filled with these torturous things that one has to get through. It's the most murderous kind of life to go through. It's very different if one adopts an attitude. It's little things that a child sees. Ah, shiur. Mustn't be late, otherwise I won't enjoy it. Just get there in time. Pity I haven't prepared enough. I would have enjoyed it so much if I would have prepared a little bit more. Then a child all of a sudden realizes a shiur is something you enjoy if you're prepared for it. A different thing. The mother says, oh, it's Thursday night again.
We get ready for Shabbos. Oh, there's my Thursday night, Friday. Again. And she shakes her head and she puts on her overalls and she goes into the kitchen. What is she teaching the children? That's what Shabbos is, a miserable day that you have to just get through, prepare for a lot of work, no reward. That's what Shabbos is. Very hard for the child in later years to break out of that. That's the responsibility we have, apart from a responsibility to ourselves, an educational responsibility to all who are around us, to show the pleasure that can be found in these things. Yes, there's a lot of preparation for Shabbos. Yes, the preparation is hard. But anything worthwhile demands and requires a great deal of preparation. And the preparation is hard. And that enhances the pleasure one gets out of it. That's what has to be taught. Not easy to constantly be teaching to others. Not easy to be constantly teaching to oneself. But that's the difference between a life of richness and pleasure on the one hand, and a life of misery on the other hand. If everything is a duty, something that just has to be done, that leaves us as empty afterwards as we were before we started. But if we look at life as a series of opportunities and challenges from which we're capable not only of spiritual growth, but also of sensual pleasures, we will find each thing that we do, no matter how difficult and how challenging, each thing that we do, we will find is a source of pleasure, of stimulation, of strength, of gevurah, enabling us to continue and to demand of ourselves higher standards still in the future.